right. Welcome to week three, as Loretta said. And once again, I want to thank Loretta for coordinating this, making this all possible, making copies of the sheets, handling all the registration, and so on. Our topic for today is twofold, really. We spent our first 2 weeks talking first about how the Torah is conflicted regarding war. Within the biblical text itself, it presents multiple messages. We moved on to see how the desired warrior is portrayed in some sources as being physically capable, energetic, and then in other sources, biblically as well as in the work of the commentators explaining the biblical text, we see them looking for warriors who are spiritually great. We then moved on from that to talk about the problem of inverted morality and the problem of sending out these young soldiers and telling them to go kill people and then expecting that, on the other hand, the behavior is going to be moral and upright. And we saw certain measures that are taken biblically to try to balance this, requiring the leaders to be up at the front with everybody aware of what's going on. We talked about maintaining spiritual discipline within the camp, the military camp. We talked about the treatment of captives. And today what I want to do is wrap up some additional material on that we didn't get to last week regarding how the rabbis looked at this issue of conduct during war and inverted morality, and then move on to what may be considered the real problem, which is, once we've talked about just conduct and the way that you're supposed to behave at the battlefield, we then have to move into the question of just cause. What is considered to be a valid reason for engaging in war, or, to put it the way you just did when we were talking before, why people go to war? If you take a look on your sheet, I'm going to jump down for a second just to show you where we're headed with this, particularly because I was emailed during the week to ask when we're actually going to address this part of things. Take a look at source number 7, which is an instruction given to the Jews towards the beginning of the book of Deuteronomy regarding their treatment of the 7 tribes they're going to encounter when they enter the land called Canaan. And the biblical text says, God will place them before you and you shall strike them. Destroy them, you shall not make any covenant with them. It's pretty unequivocal. If you take a look at source number 8, we've seen already the first line of this source, but now we'll see the rest. When you draw near to a city to fight against her, you shall call to her for peace. Right? So far, so good. And if she will answer with peace and open to you, the entire nation found there will be for tribute to you and will serve you. And we've talked about that a little bit. And then, if she will not make peace with you, and she will make war with you, you shall besiege her. And God will give her into your hands. You shall strike all of her males by the sword, only the women, children, and beasts, and all in the city, all of her spoils you shall take yourselves. You shall consume the spoils of your enemy who God has given to you. And then finally, in source number 9, regarding the command to go to war against a nation called Amalek, now go and strike Amalek, and you shall destroy all that he has, and you shall not have mercy upon him, and you shall kill man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and donkey. So that, yeah, it's all there. It's all there in your biblical text. The first two sources are read once a year as part of the weekly Torah portion. The third one is the Haftorah on the Shabbat before Purim every year. So, how in the world do we deal with this in our religion? So, I'm not actually taking questions on this right now. This is all just to make sure you stay awake, because we have like 15, 20 minutes to go before we get to this. But,
Rabbi,
doesn't it sound like it?
Why is the city feminine?
City is feminine in general in Hebrew. The word in Hebrew for a city, ir, is a feminine word. So, yes, it's feminine here, it's feminine throughout biblical text. So, keep that in mind as we go through this, and recognize that where we're headed is some pretty tough material. But before we get there, I wanted to wrap up last week's discussion about just conduct, the way that you act in a time of war, and this vision of trying to maintain some morality. Last week we dealt with it from a biblical context. I wanted to show you something in terms of rabbinic teaching. Take a look at source number 1, please. Source number 1 is a verse from Samuel 2, Shmuel Bet, regarding a man by the name of Benayahu ben Yehoyada. And take a look at this description of this gentleman, and then we'll talk about who he is. And Benayahu, son of Yehoyada, was son of a mighty man of great deeds from Kabtzeel. He, not the father, but Benayahu, struck the two altars of Moab, and he descended and struck the lion in the pit at the time of snow. This is evidently some story that they are familiar with, a legend regarding a warrior who did something with a lion. We don't actually know the full story here. He struck an Egyptian of great appearance, mighty would have probably been a better translation, who was holding a spear in his hand. And he descended to him with a staff, and he grabbed the spear from the Egyptian and killed him with his own spear. This is what Benayahu, son of Yehoyada, did. If I were to read just that source, how would you describe, besides, you know, parroting the words in the sentence, but how would you sum up the identity of this person, Benayahu ben Yehoyada? Sorry? Yeah.
Someone like an authority was someone that's the head of something.
The head of something? Could be. Yeah.
Self-defense.
Self-defense. Right. Extrapolating from this, in terms of this this story, you're right. He's holding a staff. The other fellow is holding a spear. This fellow is on the other side is mighty. He manages to defeat him. That's pretty good, you know. Fighting a lion. Okay. That sends a message. But so, how would you characterize him on the whole? Not from these. Not in terms of what he did here, but in general, what is this person? Yeah.
So we're going to give him physically
praise. Yes. He has an agenda. Yes. Oh, you mean because he strikes the two altars of Moab, so therefore this is something ideological as well. Yes. What I draw from here... Sorry?
I think he's either a warrior or a hero.
Right. I mean, this is somebody who is a warrior. This is somebody who is standing up... In one case, clearly, when you're fighting a lion, it's not ideological. But he represents something for the nation. Now take a look at source number two, where the Talmud has, I brought you a piece of a longer line. The Talmud says, Benayahu ben Yehoyada was actually the head of the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin is? The high court. So he's actually here. The Talmud here is using shorthand, but he is described as being the head of the Sanhedrin, your chief justice. That's pretty good. When your chief justice is wrestles with lions, I assume that keeps the lawyers in line, or maybe not. But the idea here is that what we're associating righteousness with the warrior, with the leading warriors. In other words, it isn't supposed to be a Jewish society in which you have your warriors on the one side and then you have your scholars on the other side. The warriors are supposed to be scholars, the scholars are supposed to be warriors. There's an idea of excellence in all fields. It's supposed to be blended. It's not supposed to be two separate things. And sort of here you have the people who are pious and righteous and they pray all day. And then over here you have the people who do the things that the people over here don't want to think about. Right? That's not what's envisioned. That's what happens in many societies. But that's not what's envisioned here. The rabbis are doing here, and they're basing the association of Benayahu with the Sanhedrin on biblical verses. But the core idea is that there's supposed to be righteousness among the leaders of the military effort. And so, the Talmud also mentions, I didn't bring it here just in the interest of space, but the Talmud also mentions the system for going to war. You know, today, in Western democracies, in order to go to war, you generally need approval by some legislative body, right? In the U.S., Congress has to approve it, unless you just don't call it war. If you call it something else, then they don't. I don't know the system in Canada, but I'm assuming also you need some kind of parliamentary approval. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Right. You need some kind of formal approval. Well, that's actually a couple of thousand years old in Jewish culture, because the Talmud records that in order for there to be a war, the king does not have the right to simply say, okay, go to war. It goes to the Sanhedrin. And the high court of 71 judges has to discuss and approve this. You have to get a majority of 71 judges, Jewish judges, to say yes to something.
What happened before the Sanhedrin?
So, Right, so that's a really good question, is what happens before we find an organized Sanhedrin? So the truth is that even in biblical text, in earliest biblical text, we have a form of Sanhedrin because we find that Moshe is given the elders who are supposed to help him lead. You going to say that? Yeah, the... Okay. Okay, no problem. The elders are assisting Moshe from the start. What role they have in making a decision like this is unclear, because you're right, the communications we find in the earliest times in the book of Bamidbar, Devarim, Numbers, and Deuteronomy are God speaking to Moshe and identifying some group and saying either fight them or don't fight with them. So there it's done much more by prophecy in his day. So that's a good question. But what we're finding is this idea of having righteous leaders involved in the military effort, and they're supposed to sue for peace first. We just saw the reference here from the opening lines in source number 8 about suing for peace first. We talked about the issue of how you treat the captives if they do indeed surrender. That we talked about already last week, but take a look at source number 3, please. Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch is commenting on a biblical verse that says, when you go to war against your enemy, ki seitela melchama loivecha, and so on. And he writes on that, a midrash emphasizes, against your enemy. The biblical text says, against your enemy. That means you wage war against your enemies. In other words, the biblical text is odd in the sense that it has extra words here. It says in the Hebrew, ki teitzela milchama al oyevecha, when you go out to the military camp against your enemy. And the rabbis are always bothered by extra words like that. That's what all of Medrash is based on, is the ear for language. And when you hear the text say, against your enemy, you sort of wonder, well, who else are you fighting? Right? And so the rabbis in the Midrash say, well, what it means is you wage war against your enemies. But that in and of itself is opaque. Because what does that mean? So what have you added by saying when you wage war, it's against your enemies? So Rabbi Hirsch seeks to explain it, and he says in this source number 3, the Torah establishes that you will battle only those who show themselves to be your enemy, from whose enmity you have suffered, and from whom you anticipate acts of enmity. Therefore, even should you attack them, you shall only defend yourself. This message rejects all wars of conquest. That's Rabbi Hirsch's position. He says that's the point of this lesson. You only fight the people who have demonstrated enmity. Now, how that's going to fit in the litany of biblical wars is a really good question, because there are certain wars that seem an awful lot like wars of conquest. So that has to be addressed. But that's what he sees. That's the message that he teaches from that verse, and we see it throughout rabbinic teaching. If you take a look at source number 4, Rabbi Hirsch, remember, was the beginning of the 19th century. Now we're jumping back in time to Rabbi Yossi Haglili. You're talking about 2,000 plus years ago. And Rabbi Yossi Haglili said, peace is so great that even during war, one may only begin by seeking peace. That has to be your first option. And Maimonides writes in source number 5, we may not, now I'm jumping ahead to the 12th century, so we're flipping back and forth in time as we do this. We may not declare war upon any human being, anywhere, until we first sue for peace. This applies both to authorized wars and obligatory wars. Now, the definition of authorized and obligatory is complex, and I didn't want to get distracted by going through it. There's a lot of discussion about this, but essentially, an obligatory war is a war that either you have a biblical command to engage in, think like the war against Amalek, which we'll have to come back to, that we have to discuss still, or a war of self-defense in which you have actually been attacked. An authorized war is a war that you are licensed to do, but isn't in one of those categories yet, such as where you suspect you're about to be attacked. So you are authorized in what could be called preemptive or preventive war. And again, the nuances of that really require an in-depth discussion that's beyond the scope of where we're going to get right now. But he writes, whether it's an authorized war or an obligatory war, no matter what, you have to sue for peace first. As it is written, and when you come close to a city to fight against it, call to it for peace. That's actually, I did the translation number 5 and the translation number 8, but I translated the same verse slightly differently. So that's a mistake. But it's the same verse as you see in the beginning of number 8. When you draw near to a city to fight against, that's the same thing. Should they make peace and accept the laws in which Noahides are instructed, we would not kill anyone there. We would collect taxes. As it is written, they will pay tribute to you and they will serve you. He's talking about the Noahide laws that we talked about last week. So if they agree, we're not going to kill people. We're not going to steal. We're going to set up a system of courts. We will not commit acts of sexual immorality. Then you say, okay, we're good. You will have to pay us taxes. We are now the reigning government. But that's the limit of it. And in practice, the rabbis believe that this is what Jews did when they actually entered the land of Canaan and fought their wars. If you take a look at source number 6, we find a passage from the Jerusalem Talmud. Joshua, sent 3 messages into Israel before the Jews entered the land. Okay, think of those leaflets that the IDF drops. So they didn't have the planes, so he had to find some other way to do it. But here are the leaflets. Whoever wants to leave may do so. If you want to, just get out now, go for it. Whoever wants to make peace may do so. You want to accept that you will follow these 7 principles? We're good with you. Whoever wants to make war may do so, which, as we know, ends up being the story of the book of Joshua. The nations that primarily, not exclusively, but primarily opt for war. So what we see in this section is an extension of what we already saw last week, which is the emphasis is on trying to accomplish peace. The emphasis is on trying to get the soldiers to be righteous and to be led by righteous people. All of which brings us back to what I showed you in source number 7, number 8, number 9, 15 minutes ago, which is a set of verses that absolutely instruct to destroy the enemy. To either in number 8, it talks about wiping out all the males. In number 9, in the war with Amalek, it goes even further, and you're wiping out all the human beings, and you're wiping out all the animals, the whole bit. So the question is, how does this jive? How does this fit everything we've been saying? We're talking about pushing for morality, and pushing for righteousness, and pushing for piety. And this isn't, to make matters entirely clear, 7, 8, and 9 are not talking about a war where you have been attacked. This is not talking about, ISIS invaded and now you're fighting back against them. That's not what we're talking about. This is, you are entering the land. In the case of 7 and 8, it's talking about you are entering the land and you're going to encounter tribes there, and if they don't make peace with you, this is what you're going to do. Number 9 is different. Number 9 is Amalek, who attacked the Jews first. 9 is going to require its own discussion. But this is a real problem. It's not a problem on a practical level, because we don't even know who these tribes are. And so going back already to Talmudic times a couple of thousand years ago, this was understood to be academic. There was no identification of the tribe of fill in the blank. We know them, and yes, we have an obligation to go to war against them. It wasn't a practical question, but it's a philosophical question. Where does this belong within Judaism? And here again, we reprise some sources that show that this shouldn't be our identity. Take a look at source number 10. This is a remarkable story. This is a story of the Gibeonim, the Gibeonites. To make a long story short, because I have to, there's a point in time when Shmuel, Samuel the prophet, has committed what could be called the cardinal sin of Middle East politics. He was told to by God, don't blame him. But he coronated the new king while the old king was still alive.
What?
He coronated the new king while the old king was still alive. No, not in the Middle East. Not then, not now, not ever. So what happens is, though, God told him to name David as the new king, but Saul is still alive. And there's a whole saga there in which Saul pursues David, wants to kill David. Word gets out that David has found help in the city of Nob, which is a city of priests. And again, I'm really giving short shrift to an important story, but Saul has the entire city wiped out. there's only one Kohen, one priest, who survives, a gentleman by the name of Eviatar. But unintended consequences, aside from the obvious disaster and catastrophe that that involves, unintended result. There's a tribe called the Gibeonites, Gibeonim. They are actually Canaanites who made peace with Joshua. Okay, that's a story again in its own right. It's in Joshua chapters 9 and 10. Read it. It's an interesting read. But they made peace, and their job in this Jewish society in the land was support staff for the priests. They took care of tasks that the priests would be focused on their work in the temple, and they were supported by the priests. Well, the city of Nob, all those priests there are all dead. The Gibeonites are starving because they have nobody now to pay them. They have nobody to support them. Their economy has collapsed. So that's what happens here in the verse that's quoted at the start of source number 10. The Gibeonites, Gibeonim, come to King David, and they say to him, "We have neither silver nor gold with Saul and his household," meaning we don't want money from Saul for what he did to us, for the catastrophe he brought upon us. We're not interested in ransom. "We have no man," and I added in brackets, "to kill in Israel. We're not interested in waging war against the Jewish people as a whole. What we want as recompense for what we have lost is the following. Let 7 men of his children, of Saul's children, be given to us, and we will hang them before God." That's their demand. Saul ruined our support system by taking away these priests. Some of us have died as a result of the hunger that we've had as we've been struggling economically. So what we want is to kill 7 of Saul's heirs. Saul's gone by this time. King David, that's the end of the verse. Read the passage in Samuel 2 to see how the story plays out. But the Talmud says here, King David tried to appease them, and they would not be appeased. At this point, King David makes the following comment. He said, "There are 3 signs for this nation," meaning the Jews: merciful, bashful, and generous. That's supposed to be, says the Talmud here, through King David, the 3 signs of being a Jew. And they quote verses to support each 3. Yeah, we do bashful real well. They 2 out of 3 ain't bad. He says, "One who has these 3 signs is suited to cleave to this nation," and he decrees after that that no member of these Gibeonim, the Gibeonites, is going to be allowed to marry in among the Jews because they exhibit this great cruelty. That's not a trait that we can have. That's the passage here in the Talmud. And again, this story really requires its own examination. I'm not even going into what David actually told them in response and the aftermath of this story. But the point that I wanted to show here is that it's taken as axiomatic that a Jew is merciful. That's supposed to be fundamental to our identity. And the rabbis saw this throughout biblical text. If you take a look at source number 11, this is before the encounter between Yaakov and Esau, Jacob and Esau. The text says, "Vayira Yaakov me'od vayetzer lo," and Jacob was very afraid and it pained him. And once again, the rabbis listening to this say, there's something funny here, there's a redundancy. If he's afraid, obviously he's pained. What do you need to say? "And he was pained." So if you take a look at source number 12, you find what the Midrash does with this. He was afraid lest he kill. He was pained lest he be killed. He doesn't want to be killed, and he doesn't want to be a killer, right? I'm sure at least some of you are thinking of Golda Meir's line, right? About being upset. And there are various versions of this that you've seen around. But that she doesn't hate the Arabs for killing our children, she hates them for turning our children into killers. That's not original with her. The Midrash sees it here in this story with Yaakov, with Jacob. There are other passages like this. If you take a look at source number 13, this comes in the aftermath of what may be called the worst massacre by Jews committed certainly in Genesis, but perhaps in the entire Chumash, in the entire 5 books. And that is the story of the city of Shechem. Remember the story? right? Dina is being held. The Torah says vayaneha, that she has been raped by the prince of the city of Shechem. This fits into a broader picture of what the city of Shechem means for the Jews biblically. It's not a story in a vacuum, but we're not studying Shechem right now. As the story goes, the leadership of the town say, we'd like to cut a deal. And the deal we'd like to cut is, we're going to make peace with you guys. Let Dina stay with us, and we'll go into business together. We'll become one big happy family. And Shimon and Levi, two sons of Jacob, say to them, absolutely, sure. The only thing you have to do is this circumcision thing. And they agree to have the circumcision, and then 3 days later, when everybody is vulnerable, Shimon and Levi go in and wipe out the city. So that, and they take the spoils also of the city. So the rabbis discuss at length why Shimon and Levi did what they did. It's a very interesting discussion in its own right. Of course, you know that Jacob condemns them afterwards. Why he's condemning them, what his motivation is in condemning them. Is he motivated by horror by what they've done? Is he motivated by fear because of what's coming next now that this small family has wiped out Shechem, who's now going to attack the Jews? Take a look at source number 13. Comment again by Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch. He says, now the blameworthy part begins, which we need in no wise excuse. This is Old English. He actually wrote in German. So this is a translation from the German, done by a translator who knows German. But I didn't want to tamper with it to make the English better, because leave it as it is. I don't know the original German. So, which we need in no wise excuse. Had they killed Shechem and Hamor, meaning the king of the city, the prince of the city, there would be scarcely anything to say against it. But they did not spare the unarmed men who were at their mercy, and went further and looted, altogether made the inhabitants pay for the crime of the landowner. For that, there was no justification. For that, Jacob too reproached them. Jacob says to them, you know, the rapist, fine. Everybody else? What are you doing killing out the rest of the city? Now their response to Jacob, he does comment on here, their response is, Hachizona yaseh et achotenu. Is he going to turn our sister into a zona? A zona being a term for somebody who is very promiscuous. So their one answer, Hachizona, gives their whole motive. The Lord would never have allowed himself to act as he did were it not a question of a foreign, forsaken Jew girl. That was the thought that brought home to the minds of Shimon and Levi that there are times when the family of Jacob too must grasp the sword. They had no desire to act prudently. They wanted to make themselves feared so that nobody would attempt anything similar. The daughters of Jacob were not to be considered as being at anybody's disposal. But nevertheless, they went too far to take revenge on innocent people for that which powerful ones had done. So that's the struggle that's going on here about the events in Shechem. And Rabbi Hirsch goes further with it in source number 14 when he talks about even the importance of protecting animals. He says, there are probably no creatures that require more the protective divine word against the presumption of man than the animals, which, like men, have sensations and instincts, but whose body and powers are nevertheless subservient to man. Man becomes the torturer of the animal soul, which has been subjected to him only for the fulfillment of humane and wise purposes, sometimes out of self-interest, at other times in order to satisfy a whim, sometimes out of thoughtlessness, yes, even for the satisfaction of crude satanic desire. I'm curious what the German was on that. Behold, he says, here you are faced with Hashem's teaching, which obliges you not only to refrain from inflicting unnecessary pain on any animal, but to help, and when you can, to lessen the pain whenever you see an animal suffering, even through no fault of yours. He's referring to the biblical mitzvah that if you see somebody's animal struggling with a burden, you're supposed to unload the animal. So this is understood to refer in general to the importance of caring about the pain of the animal, and he continues to say, above all, those to whom the care of young minds has been entrusted, see to it that they respect both the smallest and the largest animal as beings which, like man, have been summoned to the joy of life and have been granted sensitivity. And do not forget that the boy, who in crude joy finds delight in the convulsions of an injured beetle or the anxiety of a suffering animal, will soon also be dumb towards human pain. So even to that point, and by the way, when I bring you Rabbi Hirsch, it's not because he is the one voice I could find that talks about the importance of this mercy. It's all through rabbinic writing. However, he happens to do it really, really beautifully. And that's why I keep on going back to the well, so to speak, with Rabbi Hirsch. So having now said all of this, right? Having said that you have to worry about the animals, having said that you have to worry about human beings and you can't just kill wantonly, and that even if Shimon and Levi are concerned with defending the status of the Jewish people, that they not be attacked in the future, nonetheless, they're wrong, and Jehu criticizes them for it. And having said that the trait of the Jew is to be merciful and that Jacob doesn't want to have to kill anybody and so on. And having said everything we said for our first 2 weeks about the importance of mercy in a time of war and not blocking off all the exits that they're able to flee and so on and so forth, what do we do with 7, 8, and 9? What are we supposed to do when we have commandments that say, we already read it in the beginning, right? Strike them, destroy them, do not make any covenant with them, strike all her males by the sword. What in the world are we supposed to make of this?
Is that a light from the generations?
Well, if it is, maybe this is one area in which we've succeeded. That's the one they've learned from us.
She asked
if that's being a light among the nations. If they've learned anything from us, maybe it's that. That's what they picked up on. The rest of it, not so much.
It's always going to be a dichotomy.
Yeah. Marilyn says it's always going to be a dichotomy, meaning what?
You're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. You are. You have to defend yourself. You have to do these things. On the other hand, you're supposed to be merciful and seek peace. It's hard to seek peace when someone's coming at you with a gun or a saber.
Right.
It's very hard when your daughters are being molested. So it's always a dichotomy. It's back of your mind. I'm supposed to be merciful. I'm supposed to ask for peace.
Right.
So that's always been the point. Still is.
So Marilyn takes the view that war is, and this was said way back when at the beginning of our first session, that war is a necessary evil. And this is the way it goes. You're in a tough neighborhood, and if you're going to survive, this is the way you're going to survive. Even if you don't like it, it's what you need to do. And that's certainly, I think, consistent with many of the sources. But you then have to ask yourself, put yourself in a world not of today, but in a world of 3,000 to 3,500 years ago, when there were stretches of land that were not populated by other people. And God brings us into this land where there are tribes living in their various cities. And he doesn't say, take the land they're not in, because there are large stretches of land that are not yet populated at that point. But instead he says, go after them. Go after, the Cani, Knezi, all the different tribes that are living there. So we picked a fight. We didn't just defend ourselves. Yeah?
We picked a fight because God wants the idea of Judaism or the idea of one God to triumph, and these people are pagans. They indulge in child sacrifices and so forth. So the idea of eliminating that element is ostensibly what God's commandment entails.
Okay.
Whether it's exactly. As Rochelle says, it is a cleansing sort of thing.
Yes.
And it doesn't sit well with us at all, I don't think, at this point.
Right. So Ruth suggests that this is ideological. It's not so much about the physical threats to your survival as a nation. It is about ideology and God saying that I've had it with the Amori, I've had it with the Canaanites, it's time for them to be simply eliminated. And as Ruth says, this doesn't sit well with us. We have a hard time with the idea of one culture judging another culture, let alone sentencing them. So this is without a doubt difficult. But I think with certain caveats along the way, that's actually what's going on. I think that's exactly what's behind it, and I'm going to demonstrate that, I think, through the sources.
How does that explain the ox and sheep and camel and donkey?
Well, I think it explains it very well.
Okay.
In other words, no, I think that's the point. In other words, what Ruth is suggesting and what I think is accurate is that this is about saying that society is a criminal society, and I don't want anything of it in my land. We're going to see that there's more nuance to it than that, but that would be all their property, everything. Because once you start taking their property, that's symbolic of something, of a degree of acceptance of who they are. Once you take from their wealth, you're absorbing of them into yourself, and the statement is, you shouldn't have any of that. But we're going to see more with this. I'm not done because we've got, 25 minutes to go. So we have to see more of this, and we have to see it in terms of the sources themselves. Brenda, you were going to say?
Well, it's difficult, and it's difficult to absorb this kind of directive. And when we read and criticize, kill every, there's a Jew hiding behind a tree. Go get the Jew, no matter where he is. How can I condemn that when it's right here doing the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I would point out a couple of differences in that, first of all, they're writing this in the 7th, 8th century in the Quran, 7th, 8th century Common Era. They're not facing Jews as a threat to anything. And there is no Jewish society at that point. It's been subsumed by the church. It's hardly the case that is described in terms of entering into Canaan. But fundamentally, your broader point, I think, is dead on. We become the guilty. It's very hard to criticize anybody else.
The position of having to defend and. Someone says to me, well, have you read the Tanakh? Have you read it? Yeah, here it is. So it's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And this isn't an airbrushing session. That's why I brought this, because this is something we do need to know about. Again, I think there's more to it, which I want to get to, but I'm going to take Stephen and then Sheila, and then I'm going to get to explaining it, or explain what I can of it.
Is it a little bit like a flood? God can't have his people conquer and as captives and bring evil into their society. Instead, he must eradicate the evil because it's an affront to God.
Well, that's equally problematic. Right? I'm not a fan of the flood either. It's a, the flood is different because, we give little kids stuffed animals like the boat with the, and so we stop thinking about what's going on outside the boat. But that's not something I'm really comfortable with either. I mean, look, let me make myself clear. I'm a believer in Torah from Sinai. I'm a believer that this is a text given by God and not written by human beings. So I have a problem. It would be very easy to take the approach of human beings wrote this and put it together and they were barbaric and therefore what they wrote was barbaric. That's not an out for me. So flood, throw it right in there, right into the mess with all of this. And then Sheila was going to say.
I agree with Brenda about it being very difficult to defend. However, this was written thousands of years ago. And over the years, we have learned through maturity and education and whatever to behave differently. And we do not, for the most part, take a lot of this literally anymore. But that's what the Muslims say too. They say, no, yes, it's there, but we don't do that.
But they do.
And we try not to.
So, a couple of points that you're raising here. Number one, the point that this was written for a very different world. And the truth of the matter is that, assuming we get to what I wanted to do in week six, we're going to see the thought of Rabbi Cook, and he is a staunch believer in that idea. He even puts forth the idea that the reason why God sets in motion the events that involve the destruction of the Second Temple and expulsion of the Jews from their land is because, as he puts it, the world was too barbaric. You couldn't run a country in a sophisticated, proper way, and therefore God said, I don't want the Jews running a society, I'm going to wait until things are better. Of course, Rabbi Cook passed away before, you know, 1948, so he didn't get to see what it's like to run a society today. But there is such an idea that, yes, this was meant to take care of a certain situation at a certain time. It was not meant to be for all time. There is such a concept, which I want to get to discuss.
How can we absolve God from his responsibility in this whole story?
Oh, far from it. I think God is the problem. I'm serious. In other words, that's my point. In other words, this is not a question of how does a Jew, an individual Jew living, then practice this. My question is, if this is really supposed to be God's book, how do I understand it? So I would love to be able to have the conversation also, but I want to make sure that we actually see this, because if we have to do this into next week and start in the middle of this topic, I don't know what I'd be tearing out my hair. So this is what I understand. And again, this is my understanding, and there are probably others who have better explanations than I do, but this is my understanding, and I'm the one sitting here. To my mind, this is about the Canaanite tribal identity, and it is a statement, as Ruth had said, that is being made, that the Canaanite tribal identity, what they do, is unacceptable. If you take a look at source number 15, this is a statement that is made not when the Jews are entering the land of Canaan, but rather, it is a statement that is made to Abraham. When God makes the covenant with Abraham, telling him, your children are going to have this land of Canaan, it's going to be theirs, he says to him, but there's going to be a detour along the way. They're going to be strangers in a land not their own. They're going to be made to be slaves, right? The story that ends up being Egypt. And he says to him, V'dor revi'i yashuvu heina, source number 15, the fourth generation shall return here. Why does it have to take four generations? Not because they need to be slaves in Egypt. That's a separate adventure. Kilo shalem avon ha'emori ad heina, the sin of the Amorites is not yet complete. He says, it's not time for the Jews to get this land, because the Canaanites are not guilty enough yet. The Canaanites don't deserve to be kicked out of this land yet. When I bring in the fourth generation, it's going to be because I've had enough. Right now, they can still repent. The Canaanites can still set things right. So I'm not yet going to punish them. I'm still waiting. So much so, if you take a look at source number 16, this is now addressed to the Jews who are on the cusp of entering the land. Moses turns to the Jews and says to them, oh, you're leaving at the good part. Moses turns to the Jews and says, not due to your righteousness and the straightness of your heart do you come to take their land. He says, don't kid yourself. Right? He's been leading the Jews for 40 years in the wilderness. They built the golden calf. They had the incident with the spies. They complained about water. They complained about meat. They complained about the bread coming to them from the heavens. They complained about pretty much everything possible, and that's all in the first year. We don't get what's happening in the intervening 38. It's not recorded. We don't know about all the adventures that occur then. He says, don't kid yourself, it's not because you're so righteous and wonderful that you're getting this land. Rather, due to the wickedness of these nations, does your God take them from before you? It's because God is fed up with them. Who are the them that we're talking about? This is the nation of Canaan that we've been introduced to from the beginning of the biblical text. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra notes that whenever you see stories in the biblical text that describe nations other than the Jews, it's meant to teach you about them because they're going to be your neighbors. It's meant to convey an identity which goes beyond the individual story itself to say, and this certainly is not a popular idea, but that's what he says, writing 900 years ago, what the characteristics that are displayed in this story represent the tribe as a whole. So when Canaan, the one for whom the land is named, forerunner of these tribes, is first displayed in the Torah, It's with guilt for the humiliation of his drunk grandfather after the flood, right? He is the one who is cursed after the flood. We meet Sodom and Amorah, those five cities that live around what would become the Dead Sea, and we are told that they are hostile to strangers to the point of molesting the stranger. That's what we're told about the people of the city of Sodom. You have Gerar, the Philistines. Abraham and Sarah go to the city, and the first thing they want to know is she married? Because if she is, we'll get rid of her husband. That's what's presented to us in the Torah. And then again, the next generation, Isaac and Rebekah go there, and again, same fears, same concerns about them. The city of Shechem, we mentioned before, in terms of Dinah, the rape of Dinah, and then we find that later on, the same idea comes up later on. I wrote twice, but I'm not sure what I was thinking of when I wrote twice. But the same idea is going to come up later on in the story of Yericho, the story of Jericho, when Rahab, right, is there and she is acting as a zonah, and we are taught that it's actually a career that she was forced into from her youth. When she was 10 years old, she was forced into that role. This is what the Jews are told biblically about the tribes in the land. And what they're told is God does not want that to continue. He is horrified by having this happen, and he's bringing you in order to eliminate that society. But not to eliminate the people, to eliminate the society. And therefore we are told, you call to them for peace. And the terms of the peace, as we already saw last week, is it on the sheet still? In source number 5, is for them to accept the laws in which Noahides are instructed. The laws that we listed last week's sheet, I didn't list them again on here, not to kill, not to steal, not to commit acts of sexual immorality, not to worship the gods of Canaan, not to blaspheme against the God of Israel, to create a judicial system. Not to eat flesh from a live animal, that odd one in the mix. This is what God says I want for the Canaanites. I want them to accept these basic principles. And that's the way the Jewish tradition has absorbed and understood this. That it's a matter of the immorality seen there. I brought you source number 18. This is a verse from Leviticus. When the Jews are given the laws prohibiting incest, they are also told what you see in number 18. Like the deeds of the land of Egypt in which you dwelled, you shall not practice. And like the deeds of the land of Canaan to which I am bringing you, you shall not practice. And their laws you shall not follow. Because they sinned with this immorality, they sinned with this corruption, and it's from the family on up, because that's the laws of incest there. God says, that's what I want you to avoid becoming. If you take a look at source number 10, one more piece to this.
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh, I can't see you, Shana.
Accepting that the goal of the prophet is the destruction of these societies, does it have to be at the hands of the Israelites? And with Sodom and Amorah, God does it himself.
Mm.
And we are, so to speak, guiltless. And in fact, moreover, Abraham tries to defend the indefensible and asks God to save Sodom and Amorah.
Right.
So that's a tremendous example of chesed. And so granting your premise that God's goal is the destruction of these societies, does it have to be us who do it?
Right. So just to repeat the question for those on this side, it's really two questions in one. Question number one, earlier in the biblical text, when God is horrified by a society and feels that they are evil, he does it himself. We mentioned the flood as one example. Shana mentioned the destruction of the cities of Sodom and Amorah as another example. God does it. Why does it have to be the Hebrews as the ones who are going to do this? Why is that for nice Jewish boys? We'll talk about whether women go to the military in a later class, but why is this what the Jewish boys are engaged in? That's question number one. And then the separate question is, with Sodom and Amorah, actually Abraham tries to defend them. He argues with God on their behalf. So I'm going to say, in terms of the Abraham one, I'm going to give what I think is the easiest answer, although I think that there are probably multiple that you could give. And that is, if you look at his argument with God, is maybe there are righteous people in the city who don't deserve to be destroyed. He doesn't say, God, don't destroy the wicked people. He says, well, maybe there are some good people among them. And as his total runs out, maybe there are 30, maybe there are 20, maybe there are 10, when he drops below minion, he says, forget it, I'm going home. I think there is a certain concession in his argument of, you know, that there does come a point where you say, enough is enough. In terms of the broader question, though, why does this have to be done by the Jews instead of being done by God's hand? I think that as they enter, we do find initially that there are miracles in which God says, I'm taking care of this. And it's only once they sin that you see it come more into the hands of the Jews. But I also think that there's a certain lesson involved. There's a fear, which is borne out, frankly, by the rest of Tanakh, that what happened with the Canaanite tribes is not unique to them. It's not that Canaan is racially evil, and that's why they did what they did. But Jews are racially pure, and therefore they're never going to become like them. It's an understanding that this is a human thing. It's been a human thing since Adam and Chava, since Adam and Eve. That people will, unfortunately, succumb to their worst desires and build societies like that. And so it's meant to be not just let's eradicate what's there, but let's teach you a lesson you'll never forget, as much as human beings never forget anything. But let's teach you a lesson that you'll never forget, and you're going to be the ones to actually carry this out, that you will learn never to replicate it. That's what I would put out there as a thought. But the question is still a solid question. You know, couldn't there be another way to teach them, and so on? Is a legitimate challenge. Take a look at number 19, just because I want to make sure to see that. This idea that I'm putting forth here is not my own invention. You know, what I'm suggesting here, that the goal is to eradicate the society, but not the individuals. We would like to see the individuals accept this, accept the Noahide laws. The Talmud itself says it. If you take a look at source number 19, it's building on an odd verse in Proverbs or Psalms, I forget, which says, He, God, stood and measured the land, saw, and released nations. This verse is actually quoted twice in the Talmud with two separate ideas. I'm bringing the one here rather than get into the complexities of the competing sources. But what it says here is, what did he, God, see? He saw the seven mitzvot the Noahites had been instructed and had not upheld, and so he exiled them from their land. He saw that they didn't keep the seven commands, the seven Noahide laws that we've already discussed. And he said, they're not keeping them, therefore I am exiling them from their land. The key point is, he's not killing them, he's exiling them. But what has exile done to people throughout history, frankly with the Jews as the notable exception? What does exile do? It destroys the identity. The people survive. You know, when people ask this question of let me not get distracted. We got 5 minutes left. It would have been a good rant, though. The idea here is that expulsion of a population ruins their identity. Sennacherib was an Assyrian king. His method of conquest was that when he moved into an area, he moved out the indigenous population and he moved in a population that he had conquered somewhere else. Because when you are rootless, number one, it's hard to rebel because you don't know the terrain. But it's also about changing your identity. It's much easier to change these people and mold them into a new society if they're not on their own land anymore. And that is what's going on here. It's the idea of saying, we are going to now change the identity of this land. No longer will it be what it had been in the past. Now it's going to be this brand new society carrying with it the message of Sinai. Again, this is not something that sits well for somebody today. it shouldn't sit well for somebody today. Meaning that we live in a world in which societies don't judge other societies. You're not allowed to judge another society and to say this is bad. You get in trouble for doing that. The whole idea of making that kind of an assessment is one that is not accepted, let alone the idea of acting on it and saying, and since they're evil, since what they're doing is bad, we are now going to wipe them out. Nonetheless, when you're dealing with a biblical text, you're talking about a text that begins with, in the beginning, God created, right? Or in the beginning of God's creation of, depending on how you translate that sentence. It starts out with a statement of, God made all of this. It's His world. And He gets to decide who is going to be where and how they're going to be where, and this is what the rules are. It's judgmental from the beginning. And this is an outgrowth of that. The statement of, God says, I don't want them in this land, because I don't want this society there. Call out to them for peace. Like we said, back on the first side, the instructions are, when you draw, source number 8, when you draw near to a city to fight against her, you shall call to her for peace. And so we saw in source number 6, Joshua sends messages saying, look, you can do the Noahide laws thing and you'll be fine. But if they don't, then that's where it goes. Then it goes into this mode of saying that society has to be removed, a new society has to come in. Now, we didn't get to the war against Amalek. I still have to come back to that. That is going to have to be next week, because the war against Amalek doesn't fit this model, and we have to talk about it. I want to just point you to one verse in source number 20, because it's something worth thinking about. A verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs. In Hebrew, V'rachamei Rishaim Achzari. The mercy of the wicked is cruel. Meaning that wicked people are merciful too. Right? And the classic example is the vegetarian Nazis in World War II. Mercy is not simply the province of good people. But at a certain point, you have to ask yourself whether mercy of the wicked or mercy upon of the wicked is actually cruelty in its own right. If you leave these people in place, they're going to go on with the molesting of strangers that was seen in Sodom. They're going to go on with the incest and rape that was condemned in Leviticus. They're going to go on with all of these different elements. The justification for removing them is, in the end, that having mercy on them is actually crueler than changing the society. That's the argument. Accept it or don't accept it, like it or don't like it, I'm expecting a flood of emails of follow-up on this. And I'm going to take one question just because we have a minute, but then I'm going to have to wrap it on that and say continue it by email, continue it in the discussion next week when we talk about Amalek. Yes?
Does some of this relate to collateral damage rather than just the extreme, let's wipe them all out or start them off?
What do you mean?
Collateral damage, like we're going in to target something.
Yeah.
But while we're targeting it, all these other people are going to get hurt. We can't help it.
Right. So I want to talk about collateral damage in a later class, so hold the question for then. But it's a good question in terms of these sources. Some of the sources seem to say, no, everybody's like this. You know, like the city of Sodom, where there aren't 10 righteous people. So it's hard to say. Thank you very much.